Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with Sarah Jaquette Ray, author of the new book, A Field Guide to Climate Anxiety.
Sarah is a professor of environmental studies and the program leader of the environmental studies program at California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt. Her work focuses on modern climate justice advocacy and trauma studies in reference to environmental issues.
Sarah is a voice we really need right now, someone with shrewd views and teachings around both confronting our climate reality while also dealing head-on with the resulting despair.
Before we get into it, we'd first like to thank our sponsor, the Japanese luxury timepiece manufacturer Grand Seiko, which brings an incredible level of craft and detail to every watch it makes. From its founding, Grand Seiko has sought to create the world's most durable and beautiful watches with the highest accuracy and legibility possible. The new SBGW279, a U.S. exclusive from the Elegance Collection, follows in this tradition, pulling cues directly from the very first Grand Seiko dating back to 1960.
As with so many of Grand Seiko's timepieces, nature is central to the watch's design. Inspired by the Oruri songbird that migrates from Southeast Asia to the mountainous regions of Japan during Rika, the seasonal phase that marks the start of summer, the blue dial of the SBGW279 is finished in an eye-catching sunray pattern. Assembled by the highly skilled craftspeople of Grand Seiko's Shizuku Ishii Watch Studio, the watch is polished throughout with a distortion-free mirror finish, and its box-shaped sapphire crystal evokes the look of a vintage watch.
To learn more about the SBGW279 or Grand Seiko's other distinctive timepieces, head to www.grand-seiko.com. And now, here's our conversation with Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So let's just get right into it and start with the phrase climate anxiety. What is your personal definition and how do you define it?
Yeah, that feels a little bit like a trick question, but I'm going to jump in with the American Psychological Association, the APA. They define eco-anxiety, which I will also sort of distinguish climate anxiety from, but they define eco-anxiety as the chronic fear of environmental doom. And I think climate anxiety is actually a little bit more specific than eco-anxiety. Eco-anxiety and environmental doom can come in a lot of different formations. People think of that as loss of animal species that they love, or worries about what's happening in the ocean, or worries about what's happening to the mining that might be in their backyard, or even pollution siting in their backyard. But climate anxiety is a little bit more amorphous and broad and can include all of those things. And so it kind of gets more acute in a way because it's bigger. Glenn Albrecht, the philosopher from Australia, he calls it global dread is a kind of flavor of climate anxiety, this sort of amorphous anxiety about any possible random things that could potentially happen in the future. The uncertainty about what that will look like is part of the anxiety. Whereas eco-anxiety, you might know what that looks like. You can see it right in front of you and you know that there's some environmental problem happening in your backyard. But climate anxiety has this feeling of, I don't know what that's going to look like. It could be apocalyptic. It could be something out of Revelations or something, you know? And so there's a little bit like of a broader definition to me for climate anxiety. And it also, it conjures up all the stuff that climate conjures up for people that's different than just any old backyard environmental problem.
And you've written a lot about taking a collective approach to thinking about dealing with climate anxiety or eco-anxiety. And in 2021, you wrote this opinion piece for Scientific American noting the, quote, unbearable whiteness of the climate anxiety conversation. And so what's the connection that you see between the climate crisis narrative and white privilege? And also, how can these sort of fears or the anticipatory anxiety lead to more xenophobia, more division?
Yeah, I think that definition of climate anxiety I just gave gives an opening for getting to what you're talking about. And I'm really glad you're asking that question, because that particular question is a little bit of a no-go zone for some people. They're like, I don't really want to get into that sticky stuff. But this is really the crux of what's happening in the sort of eco-fascist moment that we're living in is not going anywhere soon. We see changes happening in geopolitics and what's happening in Switzerland right now. It's not fringe at all in the US. We see the great replacement theory worries happening all over the world, not just in the US. And they're all rooted in this kind of, what I would say, a form of climate anxiety, actually. And climate anxiety has the potential to turn people to being very xenophobic, even violent, and certainly have a lot of anxiety about what some people call white extinction anxiety, which is another way of saying climate anxiety. So there's certainly climate anxiety has the potential, as many psychotherapists are talking about, for turning, you know, transforming our anxiety into action and doing things to alleviate that, thinking about joining in collectivities to do things to stave off the very problems or to change policy around climate. All of that's really, really great forms of expression of climate anxiety, no doubt. And I'm all for those things. But I also think that there's a real concern here that we ought to be making sure we're paying attention to, that not all actions are good for the climate or good for life on the planet. Some actions are, in fact, very violent and undermine all of our projects and efforts to create climate justice in the first place. And so there's a sense of taking up the green mantle of climate change to just be a more capacious or inviting door to walk through for box standard, old-fashioned white supremacy, which is where we want to make sure we don't go.
Yeah, and we actually recently spoke with the philosopher Olufemi Taiwo about the inextricable links between colonialism and the climate crisis. I think that very much connects to this conversation too.
Absolutely. I mean, he's talking, I just finished actually his fantastic book, Reconsidering Reparations, and I just think he's on to so many good ideas. He's the one who's bringing up the argument that we simply can't even have social justice unless we have climate justice, which is the reverse of what we usually hear, which is that we can't have climate justice unless we have social justice. So I love his flipping the script on that. And also he's talking about how the very, very roots of the whole point of his book and the root of that argument is that the climate problems are not just going to exacerbate inequality. They are caused by inequality. And that's a very different analysis. And it leads to making us realize that we cannot solve the climate problem by going around shooting people who are considered to be threats to an American white hoarding of resources. I mean, there's a real kind of lifeboat ethics that's going on with that kind of mentality that has its roots in some pretty dark sort of supremacist ideas of the late 18th century, actually. So there's a long tradition of that stuff. And people like Olufemi Taiwo know about that and write about it in all their work. So he's absolutely right on.
So looking forward a bit, you know, what are some ways you hope to bring together more people around this conversation, particularly marginalized communities? And how can this be more of a whole earth affair and less siloed?
There are so many good answers to that question. This is exactly where all my thinking is right now. For one, we have a lot of conversations. If we think about this like a Venn diagram, like you've got climate change and you've got social justice, and then you've got the emotion dimension, which is thinking about things like what is anger, fear, et cetera, do for the climate justice movement or not do for it, as the case may be with something like the Great Replacement Theory. If you have a Venn diagram of these three categories, many things are missing when you just focus on two. And what I would say the way I'd want to go, the argument I'm trying to make is to make sure that we're including all three and addressing the places where there are gaps that open up when we only look at two. So for example, if you look at just climate and justice, that often overlooks the role of emotion in all of the ways that we come up to even thinking about climate anxiety or climate dread in the first place. And vice versa, if we look at just emotions and climate, that often tends to be a very privileged, kind of rarefied white group of people who are thinking about the mental health consequences of worrying about an uncertain future. And that particular argument looks like just like a form of white fragility if we realize that an unlivable future has been the reality for the vast majority of people on the planet since forever. So there's a sense of there's an opening or an invitation if we bring them all three together to really have a solidarity moment where social politics, social justice movements come together with the climate movement to forward different models of justice and life thriving on this planet. And I really love the work, for example, there are many examples, but work like Adrienne Marie Brown's work is talking about this, where she writes a lot in speculative fiction form to think about what a just and livable future would look like. So I'm really thinking about Adrienne Marie Brown's work and drawing on that in my thinking. And of course, folks like Joanna Macy, her definition of the great turning that brings together social and ecological justice as two models of a different mindset that's required for all this. There's work happening in Buddhist and mindfulness communities that's thinking about the inner transition, as the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report in 2022, is for the first time calling for an inner transition, which is an attention bringing to life of emotion, the heart, the mind, as how powerful it truly, truly is for climate justice. And so I'm really pushing for the climate justice movement to take very seriously the inner transition as much as anything else. And I think social justice movements have been doing that for a long time, but the climate movement has been really slow to do that.
So, just to back up for a minute, we're going to get back to a lot of the ideas in the book and where you're at now, but just a bit about your early education. You started in religious studies and you wound up in environmental studies and policies by the time you had done your graduate work. How did you come to focusing your work on social justice through this lens of the planet and nature, and how you draw a connection, if you do, from religion to environmental studies?
Well, first I'd say, this kind of goes out to all young people who are listening to this, which is that, one's professional journey is total chaos. And only when you look back on it can you say, oh, there's some thread that makes sense there, So I'm going to pretend like there's some thread that makes sense there because I've made it up as I've grown older. And it's so beautiful and elegant, isn't it? But in fact, it was total chaos. And I just was sort of stumbling my way through, as you do. So that was really the reality. The reality was I didn't, I was just trying to figure out the next step. And that was how it pieced together. But the way I got into social justice and religious studies, I thought of those two things as very different, actually. I was doing social justice work mostly around reproductive justice when I was even in high school. And I had been raised I come from a Quaker background. I myself am really thoughtful about social justice. I was an activist as a young person. And then I got into religious studies really from a very different direction, not at all that Quaker thread at all. I was really interested in Zen and Zen Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism and Eastern philosophy. And I studied that in college because I thought that would just be really fun. And I was fortunate to be in college at a time where the question of what are you going to do with that degree in religious studies, even though people asked me that, it wasn't as pressing because I came out of college when having a degree in anything still got you a job, and student debt wasn't the sort of shark infested waters that it is now. Various forms of privilege allowed me to pursue that in college, which I really acknowledge and appreciate. But I didn't see religious studies as a way to do social justice, which was my youth speaking, right? That was my lack of wisdom that saw, that's inner work, that's navel gazing, that's something that isn't going to get us anywhere fast, and the urgency and speed that we need to get around to justice. So when I left college, I gave up on that stuff. And when I focused on social justice and my work after that, and then graduate work, and I had a person open the door to me to help me think about the environment as a lens through which to achieve social justice. And that was sort of the beginning of my graduate studies and thinking about the environment as a step or as a critical way to get to social justice. And it's not until my students really started to despair, and I started to really think about how are we going to engage this really, really entrenched, intractable, almost impossible problem of climate justice and climate change without a kind of spiritual or existential set of tools. And it was really the students and my own sense of reckoning around how bad things were, honestly, that made me realize the climate movement is going to need something else, not just technology, not just politics, not just economics or science. It's going to need something that's more of the matter of the heart. And so I kind of returned to my religious studies roots to figure out how to answer that question.
So back to now. If we're in the world of policy, governments, institutions, universities, what does climate emotion conscious policy look like? How do you wish these institutions were taking a view on policymaking?
That is such a good question. I've actually never been asked that question. For one, I think that if we recognize, if we take as an assumption the fact that this is going to be a very, very difficult emotional journey that's going to have a lot of setbacks, and that the fabric of the collective is both the medicine for climate change and the medicine for our own inner suffering. I think that's part of the kind of spiritual insight that comes from a lot of different wisdom traditions, that what causes us our personal existential suffering is the same thing that's causing the climate crisis. And so a set of policies or set of institutional approaches would take that as an assumption and then proceed from there. So for example, we often use urgency, fear-mongering, and even anger as the emotional tools in the mainstream policy toolkit. And that's the vast majority of what happens with the algorithms on social media for politics. Those are the emotions, those are the modalities that seem to work right now. That's the negativity bias.
Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, Greta Thunberg is a great example of that, right? Like, I want you to act like your house is on fire. She's crying. She's angry, right? She's deploying guilt for her audience. She's exploiting that very effectively. And these are all the emotional, this is the emotional vocabulary of climate discourse and mainstream politics. I would suggest that these things are actually quite undermining of climate justice, and that a very, very different vocabulary of emotions is going to be necessary to engage people. More people, more and more and more people, and to get the big things that aren't turning to turn. And I think I'll leave it at that because you can imagine where I would go with that. But there's, you know, Adrienne Marie Brown talks about pleasure activism. We all know that our brains are pleasure-seeking machines, neuroscientifically speaking. Negativity bias is a way that capitalism keeps us all brainwashed and not participating in the change that we want to see. You know, there's sort of many subpoints that could unravel from there.
So instead of just ending there, just to push it a little further, what kind of emotional, psychological capacity, you've touched on this, but paint a picture of the kind of emotional and psychological capacity people will need to create a sustainable future, just to really button that up.
I love that. This is really not what we're seeing out there. And I don't see it in my students. And this is one of those moments where I think, gosh, people who are older, who have experienced a lot of setbacks, people who've seen the arcs of things come and go, people who have suffered a lot and still figured out a way to live, people who've experienced a lot of forms of fear, people who, out of necessity, have really decided they need to entrench in collectives and community to get anywhere, to hold the net for them. These folks usually are older and they have a lot to share, right? There's a kind of aversion to elder wisdom in most mainstream culture. And so there's a real solution right there. There's so much wisdom and so much resource right there intergenerationally that young people, especially who are the ones that are the most suffering from climate anxiety, as we've seen in many studies, could really benefit from. And I think also the sort of resilience piece, a lot of people talk about resilience being kind of a bad term for lots of different ways, but I would like to hold on to a thread on resilience, which is the ability to carry on and to engage in something for a larger purpose other than just needing to have evidence that the work that you're doing is going to have the impacts you desire. I think a lot of people check out or don't even get started because they think that they're not going to have the impact that's going to be required. And I think that really stops us on climate action. That's a mindset. All we need to do is change a mindset. There's not any physical reality that has to change in order to really leverage all the potential that's out there. I feel like we're all like potential energy and we haven't been turned into kinetic energy yet. And the thing that's going to trigger us into kinetic energy are mostly mindsets about what our power is.
Which is really where your new book comes in. I mean, it's sort of billed or described as an existential toolkit. And I was wondering if you could share with us some of the most key or important or essential tools, strategies, the things that you see for being the most, I suppose, effective in terms of getting people to keep calm, stay cool in a crisis, face this climate emergency we find ourselves in.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I remember when I was thinking about the book concept, I remember thinking, I'm not going to offer 10 ways to save the planet. There's a million books out there on that already. People know how to go minimal. People know how to do zero waste or how to turn to be vegan or what. I mean, there's already books on all those very practical things, you know? And I thought that's not where my interest lies. My interest lies in what Donella Meadows, the economist who talks about the leverage points in the system. She talks about what are the top places we can make changes in a system. She talks about the mindset or values as a leverage point, the most impactful leverage point in a system. And Paul Hawkins says the most radical climate technology is the heart and mind, not a solar panel. And I really wanted to write that book, right? Well, what does that look like? And I saw my students getting all these skills, all this knowledge in their classes, learning how to build solar panels and catchment systems and learning how to make environmental policy and write beautiful environmental rhetorical statements, but they weren't even at some point even able to come to class to do that work because their emotional tanks were completely depleted. And we had the power shutoffs happen, then wildfires happen, and then COVID happened. And I mean, that's not even considering what happened in 2016 with the presidential election in the US. So, you know, my students were pretty discouraged. And I thought, well, we're never gonna, they can't even walk across the graduation stage to go and put these skills into place if they don't have the existential wherewithal to manage all this bad news. So the book is really my attempt to provide them with the tools. And it turned out, as I was in the middle of writing that book, that the global climate strikes actually happened with Greta Thunberg and everybody else kicking off. I thought, oh, these are not just my students. This is like a whole population. So I'm really trying very hard to embolden that population. And the skills you're asking specifically for skills, a couple of them in the book that have been reflected back to me as some of the more useful ones that students tend to like. One of them really has to do with the chapter that's called Claim Your Calling and Scale Your Action. And that chapter, I really criticize the myth of the individual and the myth of instrumentalism, both of which conspire together to make us all feel like we have no power and that alone we can't make a difference. And so in that chapter, I detail all the reasons why that myth is false and a different way of thinking about ourselves as part of a collective, whether we know it or participate actively in a collective or not. We are, in fact, part of a larger collective. And so I really think of the critique of the individual and the sense of ourselves as a collective as a mental shift that opens up and empowers people to see themselves differently and have a lot more power than they think they have. Another chapter that I really enjoy that's probably the one I use the most is really inspired again by Adrienne Marie Brown's work. In her book, she talks a lot about, her book is Emergent Strategy, or the one I'm referring to. And she talks a lot about this philosophy of feeding what you want to grow. And feed what you want to grow has to do very much with an almost Buddhist approach to thinking about where we're putting our attention. The very famous Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh talks about nutriments that we're consuming with our attention. We're consuming nutriments in the world around us. And by putting our attention onto a particular, you know, if you did like a pie chart audit of where your attention is in a given day, all of those things are the things that are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger in our lives. And so we can tailor where we put our attention to and make sure we're putting it like sunlight and fertilizer and water and good soil on the things that we love that are threatened by climate change and build those things and make sure those things are nourished rather than, which is the default mode for most people, be kind of gripped and paralyzed about the fear of climate change ruining the stuff that we love, right? So there's a real, that's a very different orientation to say, okay, every single time I get gripped in the doom scrolling fear mode about how bad things are, which usually has us in a self-fulfilling prophecy grip of paralysis, right? Instead of going there, constantly turning our attention to kind of a, like a mindfulness way, where as you meditate, you're always bringing your attention back to your breath. That kind of discipline is required. It's like a martial arts, you know, you're turning your attention to the stuff that you love, making sure that stuff is nourished and nurtured and has the soil to grow. Because as much of a resistance to the bad things as fighting the bad things is growing that which is better, right? So that's one of the strategies that works really well for in my life. And so when I'm feeling really bad, that's one the one I go to. I'm feeling overwhelmed. I don't want to get up today. Where is the thing I love? Okay, how can I nourish that thing, right? And make sure that stuff grows. So I think that once you start doing those kinds of things, all of the chapters in the book have a different kind of strategy like that. Once you start doing those things, you start to breathe a different oxygen. And sort of like Greta Thunberg says, hope follows action, right? You don't have hope in order to do action, right? If you think differently about the world you live in, it actually is a self-fulfilling prophecy and a feedback cycle for better and more good things. And so you'd really operate and live in a different world once you start going down this path little by little.
This is a great segue because I next wanted to ask you about basically your students, the next generation, you know, Gen Z really, and how they're dealing with the climate reality. I mean, they're facing something no previous generation at their age has had to face. And what do you think some of the impacts on them are, and how are you seeing it from your vantage?
Yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking for me to think about them. You know, in my generation, I had this privilege of sort of being able to pick and choose whatever flavor of issue or politics or cause that I wanted to get behind and put some energy behind. And like I said, in the early days for me, it was really reproductive justice. And I still feel passionately about those things. I had the systems theory approach to all of these things being interconnected, right? But, you know, young people don't really have much of a choice on the matter, you know? They're beset by this, they're being shouldered with this, whether they like it or not. They're the generation that the IPCC said, hey, we only have 12 years, you know? They were coming of age when that report came out. So that's really a terrible, terrible thing to be told without having been trained with all of these wisdom traditions. They don't have the benefit of being our 80-year-old wise grandma who, you know, lived through a first-generation Holocaust survivor to say, okay, here's how we deal with heavy, big stuff, right? They don't have that background. So they have had the training of people who have two generations before them, for the most part, have had a pretty good life. And now they're being given an existential threat that no other generation has actually seen before. It's a terrible situation. And the data that's coming out about young people's mental health around climate change is really discouraging. And it affirms what I'm seeing in my students. I think my students are really kind of like the canary in the coal mine, and that metaphor I intend around, you know, how bad things are from their perspective. When I did an activity with them, which I describe in the beginning of my book, where I asked them to visualize their future and to visualize thriving in a future, they couldn't actually do that activity. They couldn't visualize a future that they desired to live in. They couldn't even imagine it, much less figure out how to build that future. So this was a real moment for me where I thought at first that they were maybe wimpy or lacked grit or were snowflakes or just, I don't know. My first instinct was to judge them horribly. And then over time, I realized how utterly heartbreaking this was. And then the next few years, we could see it playing out across the planet with young people everywhere. And of course, there's been the fantastic study that came out from The Lancet by several of my colleagues on 10 different countries, ages 16 to 25. Something like 76% of them are really afraid of the climate, and 56 think that humanity is doomed. This is 16 to 25 year olds across 10 countries around the globe interviewed in the spring of 2021. Things are not good for these people. In an American context, actually, young people are less concerned than people in other countries. And I think that there's a direct relationship between how your proximity to climate crisis and your actual worry about climate crisis. So they have a legit reason to be freaking out. And it really behooves all of us to make sure that that doesn't happen. The new generation mode is actually apathy and being inured to it, actually. So if you bring up climate change in a class of students now, it's so different than 10 years ago, where maybe it was taboo because the politics of their state that they grew up in was against it. So that was the sort of moment we were in about 10 years ago. And now it's like, oh yeah, yawn, yawn. Tell me how I have to solve all the world's problems. Shut down. So yeah, the shutting down part is what I'm worried about now with them.
Well, and for you personally, you know, next year marks 20 years teaching college students. So you've seen quite an evolution. And during this time, you've kind of redesigned your classes toward what you call affective issues. So empowerment, trauma, anxiety. How has this shift in philosophy impacted your teaching? And in turn, how's it impacting the students?
I think that, you know, I really take to heart truly what popular education scholars like Paulo Freire from Brazil and bell hooks, a U.S. person who's one of my inspirations, who passed away recently as well. And of course, Parker Palmer, some of these really great scholars of education who basically say that successful education is an emotional endeavor, that students engage when they're engaged on an emotional register, and that they're more likely to retain information, to be able to apply information, to all kinds of things that we consider good outcomes from an education are achieved better when we take their emotional lives into account. And I'm not talking about being a therapist or anything like that. I'm just talking about the fact that trust and being understood and being seen and being respected and finding some relevance to their lives with the content that they're learning really goes a long way. And bell hooks even says they're not looking for a therapist. They just want an education that's healing, right? They know there's problems out in the world. And when they come into the classroom, they want to be at least, you know, see the way out, right? See the light at the end of the tunnel. And I just think that that's not a high bar necessarily to put. And most people get into education because they want to do that, right? On some level. So there's a real opportunity here to shift the way we do education more towards a popular education approach that these people have been thinking about for a long time. But yeah, students are traumatized by something. They walk into the classroom traumatized. So a trauma-informed lens realizes that when students get dysregulated around content that they're receiving, they blow up or have a reaction or walk out of the room or something like that, that there's good reason that there should be compassion around what's happening with the students in your interior life. And there's all kinds of strategies that we can deploy as teachers to make sure that they're supported in that. And it's a legitimate response. They don't just leave their hearts at the door when they walk into a classroom or think of their emotional life as something that they do in counseling and psychology services. That binary between mind and heart that manifests in higher education systems where, oh, you go and you deal with your emotional life in CAPS, you know, in the therapy, and what you do in the classroom is totally different and irrelevant to that. It's just another function of all the terrible dualistic thinking that got us in these problems in the first place. So yeah, I think students are emotional. They always have been emotional. We have always all been emotional. And to bring that science of emotions to bear on having effective education, not just effective for the students, but for the planet, is really the moment we're in right now.
Do you think that grief can be a creative force for inspiring change? And if so, you know, in what ways?
That's a wonderful example of what I was just saying. Grief is one of these emotions that's considered kind of taboo in Western American culture, of course. And if you have a negative, so-called negative, I'm putting air quotes around that, but if you have an uncomfortable emotional response to something that's like political or global, like climate change or any systematic problem that's happening in the world, what's happening in Ukraine, you are sort of perceived as not being able to handle it or not accommodating yourself to the bad reality of life, you know, and that this is somehow a sign of your personal deficiency. And on the contrary, I think what psychologists have long been trying to argue, of course, it's not gone really mainstream at all, but psychologists and other wisdom traditions, indigenous philosophies, all kinds of non-mainstream spaces make this case that those uncomfortable or so-called negative emotions are actually portals, even signposts, bat signals, however you want to refer to it. There's an evolutionary reason why we have uncomfortable emotions. There's real generative possibility there, especially if we can build a culture that sees it as such and creates these kind of collective ritualized ways of turning people's negative emotions or uncomfortable emotions into political change. That's really what I'd like to see. I'd like to see all of these emotions that are considered negative not being shunned, stigmatized, forced into the corner, shoved under carpets, or put into a therapy room at best, but actually turned into the leverage for political change. And that's really where I really think the next generation is already thinking about that a lot.
And you've argued that acceptance, not hope, is the remedy for nihilism. It's a quote in the book. Can you help us understand this concept of operating from a place of hope while the world is dying around us?
Yeah. That particular part of the book, if I'm remembering it correctly, is spending some time talking about death. Am I right?
Yeah. This is within the idea of death.
Yeah.
and attachment and all of this?
It's a complicated topic, and it can't be done service in just a few minutes. But of course, some people would argue that one of the reasons that we're in the predicament that we're in, and we have white supremacy and patriarchy and all the other forms of oppression, not just around the planet, is because of what Ernst Becker and others talk about in terms of terror management theory. And James Baldwin was really clear on this. A lot of people have talked a lot about, well, if white people didn't fear death, we'd be in a better situation, right? There's a sense of kind of people in privilege have been doing all of this stuff to gain power as a way to kind of sidestep the reality of mortality, right? So this is a whole other conversation. But in that section of the book, just as a way to kind of put a bookmark on it, that section about acceptance has so much more to do with, you know, there's a sort of a Buddhist approach there to this is how it is right now, right? And there's a paradox here where in social movements, there's often been a sense of if we accept the sort of surrendering to this being the reality, that means that we are condoning it or asking to continue with the status quo. And I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting sort of a both and approach here, that acceptance of this is how it is right now opens up a lot of energy and opens up a lot of inner capacity to engage in the work of changing how it is. And that is really the kind of paradoxical argument I'm trying to make in that book that I'm not the first person to make. I'm not coming out of left field to make a crazy argument there about that paradox. But people who have been social movement leaders like Grace Lee Boggs, Martin Luther King, a lot of people who we really look up to when we read their biographies realize that's where they were at with it, right? They had to get to some place where they were saying, I'm going to accept this, because hope is a little bit more fleeting than acceptance. Oftentimes people call it instrumentalist hope, where there's an expectation that if I see evidence that there's something working, you know, that I'm getting the results I want in the effort I'm doing, that therefore that will be the thing that I use to generate more energy to keep going. And people who've been doing this work for a long time will say, that's a fool's errand, you know, that's a red herring. You can't expect to see evidence that you're doing the right thing in order to, you know, justify your engagement in that. And people who have been doing that work usually draw on a more existential or spiritual reserve of acceptance or some sort of groping with mortality, actually, as a way of getting there.
And the reality of the moment. It's just such a great quote that acceptance, not hope, is the remedy for nihilism. Mm. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was really a fantastic conversation.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoy speaking with you both too.
Thanks to our episode sponsor, the Japanese luxury timepiece manufacturer, Grand Seiko, which raises the pure essentials of watchmaking to the level of art. You can learn more about the company at www.grand-seiko.com. And thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for the weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv. This episode was produced by Ramon Broza, Emily Jang, and Johnny Simon.